Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, 51552 is our text, and I want now to talk about Bellingcat, which is an online group of sleuths, of amateur detectives, if you like, who expose the true identities of the Russian agents behind the attempted assassination of Sergei Skripal in Salisbury in the UK a few years back. The chief Bellingcat man is Elliot Higgins, and he's with us now. So welcome to the programme, Elliot. Elliot, is it fair to say that Bellingcat is not just, but is first and foremost, an investigative news website?
I would say that we don't just do news, but because we are involved in kind of investigating war crimes, it often involves actually kind of building, in a sense, case files for possible justice and accountability proceedings. So there is kind of like a news angle to it, but we do kind of much more outside of that because of the kind of information that we're examining.
Right. OK. Now, you have frequently embarrassed the Kremlin. I have to get the safety question out of the way. Are you worried for your safety? Or do you think the more interviews you do, the less likely there's going to be repercussions?
Yeah. I mean, basically, our strategy at Bellingcat is to be as high profile as possible. Mm. So we're at the point now that if I stub my toe, people think Russia's behind it. So we're trying to keep that level of kind of, kind of well-known level as high as possible.
Okay, you are a pioneer of open source reporting. Now, is that just there's data freely available on the internet and you use that to build a story?
Yeah, that's right. So really, that's because over the years, thanks to the introduction of smartphones, there's been this growth of social media use across the world. And that includes places that are conflict zones or where something really interesting is happening. So you can find all this information about events that are happening thousands of miles away. Also, at the same time, we've seen more and more kind of reference imagery becoming available, stuff like satellite imagery on Google Earth or Google Street View, or kind of all this stuff that we can use to cross-reference against these photographs to confirm exactly where they were filmed. So by combining all these public sources, we're able to find, you know, really quite incredible stuff sometimes.
Okay, because like you've always had an intense interest in military matters, maybe thanks to your dad in some ways too. And you started to examine Middle Eastern conflicts, and you got videos from citizens, the social media, there's Google Earth, etc. And as you say, Google Earth allows you to see so many things where you don't even have to go there, because you can stay at home and sit on the sofa in Leicester in the East Midlands where you live. So you have video and you have photos and you have satellite. Is that what it is? You just make the jigsaw. There's a certain skill to that.
Yeah, so I mean, it started off for me really because I was always someone who's very interested in, I guess you could say, US foreign policy and the conflicts involved, because my kind of childhood, well, my teenage years were bookended by the invasion of Iraq and then the 2003 invasion. So for me, that kind of made me very interested in that area. And when the Arab Spring started happening, I was just kind of online reading about it. And I was sort of frustrated that there were all these interesting videos and other information being shared, you know, from people on the ground that no one was doing anything with because they thought they couldn't verify it. And I realized then you could use a satellite imagery to, you know, figure out exactly where videos were filmed and, you know, show or, you know, disprove that something that was being said was, you know, reality.
Okay, but like what you did was you identified weapons from Croatia posted by a jihadist group in Syria. You wrote this on a blog, and then it was front page of the New York Times, which I'm sure you probably didn't necessarily expect. Then Syria chemical weapons. And you suddenly realized what? That you kind of, this is something I want to continue doing.
Yeah, I had, first of all, basically just looking at YouTube videos intensely, found this secret Saudi weapons smuggling operation, and the New York Times published a piece about it. A few months later, it was the August 21st, 2013 sarin attacks in Damascus, and I had loads of video footage I collected. I was familiar with the chemical weapons that were used because they had appeared in previous videos, and more I was getting recognition for my work. So in 2014, I then decided that I would launch a new website that allowed people to kind of contribute their own pieces, but also teach people how to do this kind of investigation work.
Okay, well, let's take a look at one of the biggest things here in terms of We Are Bellingcat, an intelligence agency for the people, which is out now in Bloomsbury. And Elliot, I mean, you identified the Salisbury Skripal attackers. They had smeared Novichok, the lethal nerve agent, on doorknobs. Tell me that story, first of all.
So when the identities of the two attackers were released by the British authorities, quite soon after that, you had the Rush Today interview where they said they were sports nutrition salesmen. Yeah. And they're visiting Salisbury for the 123-metre spire. But at Bellingcat, we had this kind of team who was kind of operating with each for online, and one of them is a guy called Christo Grozov, who's from Bulgaria originally, living in Australia Austria now, but he knows a lot about the data markets in Russia. Basically, Russia is a massively corrupt police state, so everything that the police state gathers is basically sold by the bureaucrats on like web forums and stuff like that. Passport registration documents, travel data, all kinds of information. So this kind of went out the usual kind of open source material we were using, but it was so easily available, and Christo knew there was a good chance we could find more out about these guys that he decided to look into them. And he discovered that some of the details of these people's identities that were kind of publicly available matched to other people who we eventually were able to identify were linked to the GRU. And eventually we were able to get the photographs of those GRU people, and they matched exactly to the people who were claiming to be sports nutrition salesmen. So we were able to expose these two GRU officers who were, you know, involved with the poisoning, and show that they weren't sports nutrition salesmen, but they were, you know, part of this assassination team.
Okay, when the GRU, first of all, let's explain that. Is that the same as the kind of the MI6, the CIA, or is it like the Stasi, or what is it exactly?
It would be like MI6. It's the Foreign Intelligence Service of Russia.
Right, officially. Right, okay. So, like, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that Russia is not just a dictatorship, but that it's also a kleptocracy where the late 80s Communist Party began to direct funds abroad and into secret accounts. Like, we're talking malfeasance and political corruption on an epic scale. Does that actually make it easier for you in some ways?
Yeah, because the entire Russian state is corrupt, you know, from the top to the bottom. So, and people know that. So they think it's okay that, you know, if they've got access to a database of, you know, maybe house registrations, they can make that public. I mean, even going back over a decade, you could go to a market in Russia and they'd have CDs for sale that were like government databases that people were just selling, like at a car boot sale. And so all this information was purchased, some of it was put online. And what we've done is basically collect as much of that data as possible. And now we have a vast amount of databases and other sources that allow us to start basically systematically identifying these kind of Russian spies.
Do you know, we live in a world of online disinformation, as we well know, you know, and like, you know, we have Trump telling in 4 years over 20,000 lies and just why not kind of thing. And people believe it to the point where 74 million will go out, and so many of those will actually think that QAnon is a real thing. So, you know, or sorry, is true. So is it that for you, the truth matters? I mean, facts are easier to come by, or is it just info, true or otherwise? And if the truth matters to you, do people care?
Well, it's something we've kind of come across as a problem a lot when we've been doing our work, because I kind of started out looking at the conflict in Syria, and there was a kind of a community of basically Syria truthers, you know, people who thought, you know, Assad was a great guy, there were no chemical weapon attacks in Syria, the white helmets were, you know, evil jihadis who were kind of stealing organs. And there's a community that kind of formed around that online. And that actually has a lot of parallels with kind of other kind of counterfactual communities like the QAnon movement, or, you know, things are more absurd like the Flat Earth movement, for example. The way they're kind of radicalized online is actually very, very similar. They find like-minded people. And thanks to the internet being very good at making you find stuff that, you know, you agree with. And, you know, we have the social media platforms and the tech platforms recommending you stuff that they think you want to look like, you know, look at. They, if you believe the Earth is flat and you click on an Earth is flat, you know, Flat Earth link, you'll be recommended another one and again until you're drawn into these communities. So Bellingcat is kind of like the opposite of that. What we're trying to, you know, build an online community that is very much based off the analysis of evidence. That's why a lot of the work we do now is focused on justice and accountability, on using this kind of evidence in legal proceedings. So I've worked with the likes of the ICC and other kind of major bodies actually examining this question, because it's such a new kind of field of investigation that the kind of the people you think would know what to do with this stuff really don't, because it's completely brand new in their eyes. So a lot of it now is about, you know, building these communities that, you know, are searching for the truth, trying to find evidence, and, you know, bringing, you know, accountability.
Okay, I'm going to keep returning to the poisoning in Salisbury just to see just how rabbit hole you had to be to go down so far to find as much truth as you did. Because, you know, there was a thing where, you know, British detectives watched 11,000 hours of CCTV and they struggled to identify the attackers. At Bellingcat, we watched awaiting a point of entry. Did you find a point of entry after all that they had done and said, right, we'll go in here even if they don't want to go down that rabbit hole so far?
Yeah, it was really came back to the idea that Christo had been looking into a coup that occurred in Montenegro, an attempted coup. And there it was believed the Russians were involved. And one of the people who was arrested during that had two identity documents. And they were different personas, but, you know, for the same person. And he noticed that the birth dates, the place of birth and the first name of the person was the same on both documents. So with one of the Skripal suspects, we used that same idea, that kind of same pattern of fakery, to search all these government databases that had kind of been previously leaked online over the previous years and Christo had been collecting, to discover people who had the same date of birth, the same place of birth and the same first name as the Skripal suspect. And there was only about a dozen people, and he could work through that list, finding their real social media profiles, which allowed him to eliminate them until there was basically one guy left who didn't have a real, any kind of social media presence. At that point, he was able to use these Russian data brokers to buy this domestic registration for passports that they have in Russia, and on that was his photograph, and it matched perfectly to the guy who was in this Russia Today interview. But it had loads of really weird artifacts on it. For example, there was a stamp on it that had a phone number for the Russian Ministry of Defense. The previous passport data, which is usually filled in, was completely blank. It was like this guy just appeared sometime in 2013 out of nowhere, and this really strongly indicated this was a fake persona. The other guy, we kind of did a profile of him, of if he is a GRU officer, where would he be training, based on his approximate age, where would he be? And from that, we managed to find one particular unit, and we went through like all the members, found photographs of them, and there's like one guy who was missing, and we looked into him, and eventually we did discover that he was this GRU officer who looked exactly like the guy who was in this Russia Today interview. So yeah, we then managed to get the two identities from there.
But, like, you know, for success in a Russian investigation like this, you know, there's rampant corruption, which does help you, as I say. There is state control, but you can get the home address, the car registration, the passport details and all the rest pretty easily. And you can just, what, pay a small fee and it's yours. I mean, you don't even have to go onto the dark web. $100, there you go, the info.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you today, you know, which forum to go to buy any information you want on any Russian. And this is something that, since we've published our story, because we're very transparent about our methodology, because we obviously do get accused of, you know, being a part of the security services, especially by Russia, that we want to be very transparent. And we've had media organizations in Russia basically recreate our investigation using the same sources to verify basically where we're getting this information from. Plus, we're aware that Russia, the Russian government, changes this information when we kind of discover this stuff. So we always have multiple kind of sources to verify each kind of piece of information we're discovering. And that allows us to make very solid conclusions about who these people are.
Okay, but when things happen, like, oh yeah, they expel a few diplomats when this sort of stuff happens, they enact a few sanctions, it's no real hurt. Do you think the vast majority of Russians don't believe that Putin could be behind it, and those who do might actually approve of it?
Well, I mean, there's been surveys of this, and there is a very small fraction of Russians who actually do, you know, believe that this stuff is happening. It's, I think it's like 10 to 15%, because the entire Russian kind of media ecosystem is dominated by loyal state media who are constantly attacking, you know, anyone who brings this up. I mean, we've been attacked a lot by the Russian state media, you know, the Russian state friendly media, even Russian government officials making all sorts of claims and allegations about us without, you know, presenting any evidence. But, you know, we've been revealing more and more information about this and kind of just building up this huge kind of corpus of data and revealing more and more of these assassination attempts. And I think it does slowly start having an effect. But the problem is the international community reaction, as you're saying, is very, very weak. They dispel some diplomats, and it doesn't really, Russians don't care. The Russian government, yeah, this is the price of doing business for them. So if you want Russia to stop, you know, assassinating people with chemical weapons, and we now have, I think we're on 10 or 11 we've identified since about 2012, they'll keep going, because there's no price they're paying, basically, in their view.
Right, but I mean, like Bellingcat, like, you know, you are a giant now of the new media landscape, and we're talking open source reporting as an antidote to dictatorships, which is something you said earlier on that you're very interested in, kind of thing. The money might come from either private foundations or Bellingcat workshops or whatever. The US State Department, did they offer you millions and did you turn it down? Are you in any way involved with the CIA or GCHQ? You definitely are not working for or with them.
The funny thing, I mean, I'll say, well, not just to be clear, but the funny thing is, it's really hard still for us to fund fundraise. I mean, when I launched Bellingcat originally in 2014, it was a crowdfunded exercise through Kickstarter.
You were a blogger.
I raised about £60,000.
You now have your own media. You know, like you've got your own kind of organization, your own staff. You're not just a blogger. You're a CEO of an organization.
I mean, it took a long time to build this. I mean, we did, in a sense, grow quickly. I mean, we doubled our kind of revenue every year since Bellingcat's been launched. But it was only like 2 years ago when I stopped doing all the admin, business and finance stuff myself. I was like, spent most of my time at that point going through spreadsheets, making sure invoices were being paid. Now we're actually a fully registered charity in the Netherlands. We, have like things like a supervisory board and business director and all this kind of stuff. But that took a lot of time to build up to that. And this kind of people seem to think often, you know, even our supporters, that we're having money thrown at us by all kinds of donors, but we're really not. We really, you know, do have to really go out there and ask for money. And it's, it can be quite stressful sometimes. I mean, there were literally points early on where it was kind of a choice of keeping my office for Bellingcat or paying my mortgage or, you know, loaning myself, like going into my overdraft to keep Bellingcat's kind of bills being paid. But I'm glad we're in a position now where we're very stable financially, because it was a difficult period. But this idea that, you know, the CIA is pouring money into Bellingcat is really, I mean, it's insane.
You might like it if it did happen, maybe. Although, like, the independence of this is just fantastic. I mean, like, just to get back again, as I keep saying, I'm going to go back to Salisbury. We're talking two Russians, Gatwick, the train to London to Salisbury, hanging around Schreppel's house, false names. The fitness entrepreneurs is what they told US, or at least what they told Russian television. So you were armed with this info, uploading pictures, reverse image matches and Skype handles and for variants in whatever Russian news reports you took, Twitter, exhaustive search there. You dug into a stash of leaked databases then, and hundreds of Russian torrent sites, flight manifestos, cars, house. Is there a time when you go, look, Eureka, got it?
I mean, sometimes it's a very gradual process. I mean, you're just kind of finding all the pieces one by one, and it just becomes this kind of overwhelming sense that you found something. I mean, even when you don't have like a direct connection, you don't have like a photo of them putting the poison on the door handle, there is so much information around it that it just can't be a coincidence that two kind of GRU officers who were in contact with these chemical weapons experts who developed Novichok, it just becomes beyond, you know, belief that this is, you know, they were actually really sports nutrition salesmen. I mean, still, there's plenty of people who, you know, will believe that, you know, not just in Russia, but, you know, across the world. But we just keep on, you know, I mean, over the years since we've been doing that, I mean, we've found so much more information. We've shown the complexity of this, and we're very public about sharing as much of this information as possible. And I think it's quite an education for a lot of people.
Do you know, you cross-reference data against identification documents that the Russian state hold on every citizen, and they do hold that. So tell us about the babushka.
So this is a name we came up because we found someone on a forum who was selling information, and they said, I've got a source. You know, they were telling people in this internet forum, I've got a source that can get me these files. So we kind of, as a joke, were saying, it's probably his like grandmother, his babushka.
Babushka is grandmother, and it is her.
Yeah, just kind of digging through filing cabinets. So it was kind of like a joke we were having, because you don't really know who these sources are, because they're all kind of, everything's anonymous and it's done through kind of proxies and stuff like that, because no one wants to get kind of, you know, in Russia, they realize, you know, this is a big thing. But usually these people are selling this stuff to, say, someone who wants to look upon their wife, you know, get her phone records to make sure that she's, you know, going where she's supposed to be going and not going off with strange men, or they're kind of using it for like insurance fraud, or it's usually used for crime, basically, or spying on your loved ones, unfortunately. So we were using it for like a really different purpose than I think these most of these people were used to sending the information for.
I mean, like, when you think about the matches that came back there and top secret stuff, and that this person's existence began in 2009, so Putin is obviously lying there. This long planned trip to Salisbury, no, I don't think so. Like, we're talking about worldwide internet sleuths unmasking a Russian hit squad. It's as simple as that. Then Putin comes out, issues a foul-tempered denial, and he says she, a man in Salisbury, was a scumbag anyway, something along those lines. The fact that you get a reaction as far up the ladder of that, is that exciting, or is that just wow? How did this happen?
Well, it's nice to know they care. I mean, I think the reaction from the Russian government has been kind of the most, the best feedback we get, because they not only, you know, sometimes they issue angry denials, sometimes they kind of, like, we had the Russian ambassador to UK give a press conference where he repeatedly claimed we were part of the British deep establishment and we were being paid by the intelligence services. And the fact that they care that much that they're reacting to us like that and lying about us as well, really says more about how much impact we're having than their kind of various kind of dismissals and denials about our work.
Do you know, just other stuff finally as well. I mean, like the Russian truck that fired a missile at the Malaysian Civil Airlines in 2014, denied by Russia. You found enough evidence to just say this is exactly what it was.
Yeah, I mean, we were able to not only to track the missile launcher as it travelled through Ukraine using photographs and videos people were sharing online of it and, you know, other conversations online about it, but we tracked it to the launch site. We then tracked a missile launcher convoy in Russia in the preceding weeks and discovered that one of the missile launches in there had damage, markings, other details identical to the one that was seen in Ukraine on July 17th and was linked to the downing of MH17. From there, we just dug deeper and deeper and deeper. We found all the members of the 53rd Air Defense Brigade where this missile launcher came from, basically because they were just sharing loads of information about themselves on social media, reconstructed their entire kind of unit, showed exactly where they kind of were traveling through Russia, and found out who their commanders were. And then there were also these phone calls that were being released by the Ukrainian intelligence services that were intercepted calls of separatists and Russian speaking, and they didn't know who they were, and we figured out they were like Russian officers and Russian GRU officers, and it just turned into this absolutely huge thing. And for us, that was a really big moment, because for 2 years there was no real information coming from the official criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. So we're saying this stuff, we're providing all this detail, yet there was never really any kind of official confirmation of it. But then in 2016, they gave a press conference where they described what they had discovered, and it was identical to what we had found. And that was a really big moment, not just for Bellingcat, but the whole kind of online open source investigation movement, because suddenly you had a really important official investigation saying, yes, this is exactly what happened, and it was just what we'd been saying for 2 years.
All right, well then let's get finally straight up to date, which is now still ongoing, still happening. The biggest thorn in Putin's side is Navalny at the moment, who's currently, of course, in jail. In December, you got names and photos of several Russian agents who poisoned Navalny, the Russian leading opposition activist. Tell me how that's going so far.
So, yeah, I mean, we discovered that because we were looking at the phone records of these people we knew were involved with the Novichok program in Russia. And surprise, surprise, just before Navalny was poisoned, they had been calling with FSB members, the domestic Russian intelligence services. So we looked into them, and it just happened that their phone and travel records were identical to where Navalny had been, not just on the day he was poisoned, but on 40 trips preceding that. So whenever Navalny was going on a trip and staying in a hotel overnight, he was being followed. Mm. And then, so we basically revealed that, this is almost certainly who poisoned him. Then Navalny tricked one of them into giving a 50-minute confession by pretending to be one of his boss's staff members. And then since then, we've also discovered, we've published so far four additional poisonings, one of another major Russian opposition figure. Two of them were actually quite minor activists, and one of them was a member of the kind of official allowed opposition in Russia. And those three were actually killed. The other guy, this other big Russian opposition figure, was poisoned twice when he fell into a coma, actually on both incidents. And we've still got another, at least, I think, four or five investigations we work on now of more high-profile cases of individuals being poisoned by this same team.
Right, so Bellingcat, the story goes on. We are Bellingcat, an intelligence agency for the people. It's out now in Bloomsbury. Obviously, if you've heard the last bunch of minutes here on the programme, you'll certainly see how fascinating it is. And just one final thing before I let you go, which has to be asked. Your blog, Thingfish, Brown Moses. Brown Moses, are you a Frank Zappa fan?
I am. That's actually where it came from.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a huge Frank Zappa fan. And I was just listening to the song. I thought I'd use that as a name online.
Excellent. I love it. All right, Ellie, it's been a real pleasure. And by the way, congratulations. And obviously, this sounds like I'm talking to a 4-year-old in school, but keep up the good work. Thank you very
much.
Good luck. See you. Bye. Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.